Calliope dies. With thunderous applause.
Welcome to Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause. I'm your host, Scott, with Uncle Ian. Today, our matchup for you is Xerxes against Saddam Hussein. Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause is a history podcast obsessed with history's greatest dictators. We have created a knockout competition to determine the single most significant dictator of all time. Each episode features a matchup of two dictators where we discuss the life and times of each leader. The loser of each battle is eliminated from the tournament. The winner remains in the contest to be named history's biggest dictator. Uncle Ian, please tell us about Xerxes.
Thank you, Scott. Xerxes was a king of the Persian Achaemenid Empire back in the 5th century BC. His name means ruling over heroes, and he was descended from Persian royalty. His grandfather was Cyrus the Great, and his father was Darius. Most people have heard of Darius because he was the Persian commander at the Battle of Marathon in the year 490 BC. Xerxes was born in 518 BC. He was always brought up within royalty. Persian princes, by the age of 7, learned how to ride and hunt. By the age of 14, they were expected to have proved their wisdom and their bravery.
Like all the other princes in Persia, was raised by eunuchs.
Yes, that had been a strong tradition in the Middle East for many years, and I don't know if that's because the kings felt safer with eunuchs around, that they weren't going to be a threat to the progeny of the empire. He went through a traditional apprenticeship, going through the military. There's no records to say whether Xerxes was literate.
They preferred more of an oral tradition, didn't they?
Yes. Yeah, very much so. It might also be worth mentioning, Scott, just a little bit about how we do know about Xerxes. We've got various sources. The main source, certainly from the European perspective, is Herodotus, who was a Greek historian. He wrote in the mid 5th century BC, so approximately a generation after the life and times of Xerxes. He was one of the very first historians whose writings have survived. In the early AD years, Plutarch wrote about this period. There's also references to Xerxes in various books of the Old Testament. We should also be aware that what we learn about Xerxes is often going to be modified by the fact that Alexander the Great wasn't a fan. Now, whether that's because the Persians had a long history of opposition to the Greeks. So Alexander the Great came along about 150 years later. Ironically, he married two of Xerxes' descendants, but he and his people were involved in rewriting a little bit of the history of the times of Darius and Xerxes.
And in terms of bias, Cyrus the Great, Xerxes' grandfather, would get a lot of good press in the Bible because he freed the Jews from the Babylonians.
Yes. Now, the city of Babylon has been dated back to the 19th century BC. I can't even imagine that. So that's 4,000 years ago. Babylon was the capital of ancient Mesopotamia, which is on the Euphrates River, about 80 kilometers south of Baghdad. And it previously been in Assyrian hands, so that when Xerxes inherited the Persian Empire, he inherited the title of being king of Babylon as well. One of the other ways in which we know about Xerxes is through the archaeology. Ancient inscriptions on buildings, like Babylonian ruins, etc., plus a lot of cuneiform tablets have been discovered which give us information on the rule of Xerxes and the times. So in terms of Xerxes' rule, his father died in 486 BC, just at the time when he was planning another campaign. The Persian Empire at that time included Egypt. As soon as he became king of Persia, Xerxes was faced with a revolt in Egypt, so he had to head off there to bring that revolt under control. And then very shortly after, in 484, there was a revolt in Babylon, and the Babylonians, who by that stage had been under Persian rule for approximately 50 years, had been, without being too technical about it, had been pretty much bled. The Persians were exploiting all their resources and were taxing them quite significantly. So that was a challenge for Xerxes, was to put that revolt down.
And he was quite ruthless when he did that. I've read that he tore down a statue of their god and took it away with him to be melted.
It's interesting, that particular statue, in some sources that's called the statue of Marduk, which was very important symbolism for the Babylonians. But in other sources, it's talked about that being a statue of a man rather than a statue of Marduk. Different sources do have some different opinions on that as to how harsh he was in the suppression of that revolt. There were some elements of Babylonian society and culture that did survive. The astrologers in the temples, for example, as far as the sources tell us, were basically untouched.
So that's the reason why I have to deal with my female friends telling me that Pisces is in limbo.
It's a certain component of what we now know as the zodiac, yes. One of the other elements of the suppression of that revolution in 484 is evidence that in some subsequent inscriptions that Xerxes had dropped the title of King of Babylon from his name. Now, as we know, kings and dictators love their titles. And remember, this chap was King of Kings of Persia. He was Pharaoh of Egypt. So being King of Babylon looked pretty good on the business card as well. Over time, he did stop using that title because he wanted the Persian Empire to be seen as all-powerful, not made up of different individual states.
By dropping the title, he was sending a message that Babylon is just another part of the massive Persian Empire and you're not anything special.
One thing, though, that even despite all the diggings that have happened around Babylon over the years, there's actually no archaeological evidence for the destruction of the city and the destruction of any temples or any marketplaces. So any suppression of the revolt didn't involve flattening the building, anything along those lines. But that's certainly one of the turning points of his reign, that he was certainly prepared to exercise his authority where appropriate. And one of the things that was always on his to-do list was to have another go at the Greeks, or the Athenians and Spartans, I should say. It was 490 BC, the Battle of Marathon, and his father had been unsuccessful there. His father died in 486, so by 480, Xerxes was ready to have another go. And he put together an army, and it included Phoenicians, Egyptians, Macedonians, Ionians, Indians, Jews. So it was a pretty diverse army. He even got support from provinces like Thessaly, but also even Thebes in the southern part of Egypt. The sources do differ a little bit, but it appears that an estimate of 60,000 for the army is pretty close. Not 5 million. That would have taken a very long time to get that army over the Hellespont, although he did build a pontoon bridge. In fact, he had a couple of goes at building pontoon bridges over the Hellespont, but yeah, most sources say it was around the 60,000 mark.
Herodotus had claimed the 5 million, didn't he?
He did. Although I will say arithmetic probably wasn't Herodotus' strong point.
But he's Greek.
Yes.
The diversity of the army is interesting. A modern HR department would love his army. The empire stretched so far, it goes from North Africa in the west. In the north, it touches the bottom of Russia. And in the east, as you say, to India.
Yes, and some of those were land-based, as it were. And of course, you've got the Phoenicians who were really, in recorded history, were the first seafaring people in the Mediterranean. So being part of an army probably wasn't the Phoenicians' strong point because they were more of a maritime people. Various battles ensued. The Battle of Thermopylae against the Spartans.
Do you want to talk about the Thermopylae 300?
I wasn't planning to. Maybe, Scott, there's an opportunity for you to record a line that says, and for those of you who are aware of the movie 300, it's based on the Spartans at Thermopylae. Maybe a line like that would do that link nicely.
Mate, you've just done it. I'm copying, pasting that in. And therefore, I've forced you inadvertently to make a pop culture reference.
A movie reference. Good work.
You're stuck now. The Battle of Thermopylae, a very famous battle in which supposedly 300 Spartans fended off 5 million Persians. Now, that is what the movie 300, starring Gerard Butler, depicts, the Herodotus fictionalized or exaggerated version of events. Some aspects of it are true. So we know that that there is a gap between the mountains and the sea. That channel through which the Persians had to travel really condensed their numbers.
Which then gave him control of Greece north of Corinth, north of the Isthmus there, and then the destruction of Athens. But then the Greeks fought back at the Battle of Salamis. At that point in time, Xerxes was concerned that he would be stranded, that the Greeks or allies of the Greeks would destroy the bridge over the Hellespont and that he wouldn't be able to return.
Is that to get from one side of Turkey to the other side?
Yes, that's correct.
If the Greeks burned down that bridge, the army and Xerxes himself would have been trapped in Europe and couldn't return back to Asia.
That's right. And by the time they built another bridge, then they could well have been massacred.
So, and the bridge didn't prove to be that stable. Didn't the first one get washed away in a storm?
That's right. Yeah. They had to have a couple of goes. I think you'll find the engineers were learning all the time about their bridge building technique. After the Battle of Salamis, Xerxes then took the bulk of his army, interestingly, not all of it. He did leave a small army behind, and in hindsight, perhaps inevitably, that small army was defeated in 479 at the Battle of Plataea, which was pretty much the end of the Persian effort to conquer Greece.
A few of the sources also say that Xerxes left to suppress another revolt in Babylon.
Yes, which was only 4 years after the original revolt. In terms of what Xerxes focused on upon his return to the empire, he did oversee a number of construction projects, temples and various other buildings. He continued as king of the Persian Empire and continued as pharaoh of Egypt up until the year 465 BC, so he had a 21-year reign. In 465, he was assassinated by the commander of his bodyguard.
With the assistance of a eunuch.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm dropping in all the eunuch references.
Yes. The successor was one of his sons, Artaxerxes, and the dynasty itself, the Achaemenid dynasty, continued in power until 330 BC, at which time Alexander the Great became the conqueror of that region on his march east. The other area for which Xerxes is remembered is the city of Persepolis, which is in the south. Number of temples that he built in that region, and this led to a quote in a textbook which is called Brill's Companion to Herodotus, and I quote from an author named Vierdenberg, who described Xerxes as a weak personality whose faults showed mainly in his religious fanaticism, in his aesthetic enjoyment of beautiful surroundings, and he wasted his time on women of pernicious influence at the cost of state affairs. He was summed up as having an indolent nature, but also being a bigot, both on a class level but also on a cultural level. The sources differ on his religion, but he is most closely associated with the religion of Zoroastrianism.
The Zoroastrians, they were very much concerned with good versus evil, and so that is actually the origin of the same sort of dichotomy of the God versus devil in Christianity, and that also has a strong influence in Islam and some other religions. They're also very obsessed with Armageddon and the end times, which is probably where the Christians get that as well.
That would flow quite neatly, so that makes perfect sense. Yeah, in terms of his own people, there's no records of him being despotic at all. Certainly, he was conscious of his own position as king, and now, of course, as king, and given how record-keeping was 2,500 years ago, there may have been instances that didn't get reported in the media.
Against Xerxes today, we have the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was president of Iraq from 1979 until 2003. The Iraq Saddam is born into is ruled by King Faisal II, which is seen to be a puppet of the British Empire. That pronunciation is probably incorrect.
Yeah, it would have said Faisal.
Saddam was born on the 28th of April 1937 in the town of Al-Auja, near the town of Tikrit. Again, that pronunciation is probably incorrect. While in the womb, his father disappears and his older brother dies. The father is assumed dead, and Saddam's mother attempts to have an abortion and then eventually tries to kill herself because she believes that Saddam is killing the male members of his family from inside the womb. She believes that she's carrying a devil child. She's actually saved by a Jewish family, which will become ironic later on. The name Saddam means the one who confronts. Our two dictators have very appropriate names.
Mm.
Saddam's mother gives birth to Saddam, and she's very suspicious of him, and she tries to limit his activity and doesn't allow him to go to school. But eventually, Saddam's mother remarries. His stepfather is very abusive. He's bashing Saddam with a pipe. His upbringing is quite horrific. Saddam pushes to go to school, so they say, okay, you can go to school. You can go live with your uncle in Baghdad. So they give Saddam a bit of cash and a handgun and say, go walk to Baghdad. He's 10 years old, and he's walking across Iraq with a gun and a bit of cash. He makes it. Saddam lives in Baghdad with his uncle, who teaches Saddam about politics. The uncle, of course, is a Nazi, and he actually wrote a very successful political pamphlet. It's like an Arab Mein Kampf. It's called Three Whom God Should Not Have Created: Persians, Jews, and Flies. I'm with him a third of the way.
Now, if that's his uncle Talfa that you're referring to, and I think we're going to hear more about him later. If I recall, he actually gets a role in the government of Baghdad.
Yes, he becomes mayor of Baghdad.
Later on. Mayor of Baghdad later on.
You've got this devil child being taken in by a Nazi writing weird political propaganda. It's not a good combination.
No, what could possibly go wrong?
Yes, exactly. Saddam, of course, is given another gun by his uncle. Despite his dream of going to school, he pulls a gun on one of his teachers and is expelled. So things start to change in Iraq while Saddam is a youngster. Abdul Karim Qasem stages a coup in July 1958. This leads Saddam to join the Ba'ath Party. The Ba'ath Party is an Arab nationalist socialist party. The Ba'ath Party actually attempts to assassinate the new leader with guns given to them by the CIA. The CIA, for some reason, thought it would be better if Saddam and his friends were in charge. The assassination attempt was an absolute disaster. Not only does Qasem survive, but there's so much friendly fire that Saddam himself actually gets shot by one of his comrades. One has a grenade in his jacket pocket, and it gets caught on the lining as he tries to pull it out, which would have the results that you expect. So Saddam's shot in the leg. They realize that they have to escape. They make their way to the getaway car, and the getaway driver is nowhere to be found. He's actually off at a coffee shop having a sneaky game of backgammon. Because he just tried to kill the leader of Iraq, he has to flee. So he flees to Egypt for a few years. And while he's in Egypt, in 1963, Qasem is deposed and killed by the Ba'ath Party. And then in 1963, there's a coup against the Ba'ath Party. And then in 1968, General al-Bakr leads a coup again and becomes president. So the Ba'ath Party in 1968 is back in charge. So that's three coups for everyone paying attention. Malcolm Turnbull would just carry on in Iraq, wouldn't he?
There's plenty of material for another book there.
Yeah. Saddam Hussein is appointed head of Iraq security by al-Bakr because he's good mates with al-Bakr, so it worked out well for him. Everything worked out great for Saddam. Saddam, as head of security, appoints members of his own tribe that are loyal to him, uses public money to give his lackeys houses, cars, and luxury goods. Saddam really excels himself in this area. He's head of internal security of Iraq. He's running a secret police, ensuring that the government is stable. So Saddam tortures people personally with 107 different torture methods, including electrocution, lashing, stimulated drowning, acid pools, pushing cigarettes in people's eyes. You know, the classic. He does such a good job that at the end of the year, he actually becomes vice president. Towards the end of his time at vice president, he's actually the real leader of Iraq because he controls the secret police, which means he controls the fear that the government can instill in not only the people, but of the other members of government. In 1969, Iraq and other Arab states engage in the Six-Day War against Israel and lose. As the head of the secret police, Saddam publicly hangs 14 Jews as traitors. This sends a message to the Jews of Iraq. It also sends a message to the non-Jewish population. 50 years ago, there were 130,000 Jews in Iraq, and at the end of Saddam's reign, there would be 34. That's not 34,000, that's 34. Most of these people would flee to Israel, including the Jewish couple that saved Saddam's mother from killing himself. In 1972, Saddam and the Iraqi government nationalized the oil industry, giving them plenty of cash. Oil prices are high, that gives them money for infrastructure and Saddam's literacy program. He embarks on a literacy program because he decides that he wants to be leader of a great country, and a great country will need literate and educated populace. So he sets up mandatory reading classes, which if you missed, you can get 3 years in prison. So literacy actually rose to 80% under Saddam Hussein. And UNESCO gives him an award to celebrate his achievements.
That's brilliant. That was also That award, as I recall, was also based on a lot of the work they'd done with modernising the health and hospital system as well.
Yeah, and so he achieved, in the 70s, he's actually achieving some good things. In a country like Iraq, that's very religious. We should mention that Saddam was a secularist in a very sectarian and divided religious society. Part of this was that he allowed women to work and go to university, and in the 1970s Middle East is a big deal. Here's a quote from Saddam, which will surprise everybody. "Women make up half of our society. Our society will remain backward and in chains unless its women are liberated, enlightened, and educated." That is not Jermaine Greer. That is Saddam Hussein. It's off-putting to hear Saddam Hussein say something sensible. In 1979, he has amassed a great deal of power and popularity because of all these changes he's introduced. By this time, he's de facto leader. President al-Bakr, the president of Iraq, is in talks with President Assad of Syria. They wanted to unify the two countries, which would make Assad vice president of the new state, which would make Saddam's position less powerful. He would no longer be vice president. Saddam uses the military and the police, and he forces al-Bakr to resign. Saddam Hussein is now president of Iraq.
And again, one of the ironies in all of that is that the Assad that you just mentioned is the father of the current ruler of Syria.
Interesting to see what could have happened with history if that unification had gone ahead and prevented Saddam achieving full power and the Assad's been demoted.
Or the other way around, that Assad in power now could be ruling over a combined Syria and Iraq.
So like Adolf Hitler, the growing industry and economy made Saddam admired, and he had paid news editors and writers and artists for propaganda and had built a very favourable image. And there's a very famous song that you've probably heard, a pop song, that talks about how great Saddam is and isn't Saddam wonderful. So 6 days later, after becoming president, he purges his Ba'ath party of all possible opposition. One of the members of the party, Mashadi, who speaks out against Saddam becoming president, he is captured and told either to confess to conspiring against Saddam with Syria and members of the Ba'ath party, or he could watch his wife and daughters get raped and killed. So he chooses option one. And so Mashadi is paraded on stage in front of all members of the Ba'ath party. Actually, this is all televised and on YouTube if you want to watch it. It's absolutely incredible. So Mashadi goes on stage. He names 66 conspirators to his to some plot against Saddam that we don't think actually exists. But Saddam is doing this to send a message. He's trying to ensure that anyone who could possibly be conspiring against him is eliminated.
These were all members of the Ba'ath party. It was a lot like the Night of the Long Knives when Hitler purged his own supporters.
Exactly. And a lot like what Stalin had done in Russia when he came to power, purging the Communist Party of his rivals like Trotsky. And Saddam was actually a massive admirer of Joseph Stalin. Initially, 22 are shot. By the end of the next week, hundreds of party members have been killed. So here's a quote I have from Saddam around this time. He says, "There are scores of people plotting to kill me, and this is not difficult to understand. After all, we seized power by plotting against our predecessors. However, I am far cleverer than they are. I know they are conspiring to kill me before they actually start planning to do it." It's a big call, but he's right. He doesn't get undone by his own party. He doesn't get taken down by the people of Iraq. In 1980, Saddam orders his army to invade their old enemy, Iran. The war reverses all progress that Iraq managed to achieve in the 1970s because the Iran Revolution takes place the previous year, installing the Islamic Republic of Iran. And so the new leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, tells the majority Shia population of Iraq to rise up against the Sunni Iraqi government. So just to clarify, Iraq is mostly Shia Muslim, and Saddam and most of the government is Sunni. And so the Iranians trying to convince the majority population within Iraq to rise up against the government. Saddam doesn't like that. So he decides to invade Iran, but it's also because he hates Iran. And he also wants their land and oil, which would make Saddam a great leader, and who would make him not only rich and powerful, but admired amongst all the Arab states who also hate Iran because they're Shia and they're Persian rather than Arab. The war is a massive failure. It settles into this slow trench warfare that's very much like World War I. It actually goes on for 8 years and just drains Iraq of all their wealth. And the Islamic Revolution has the Iranians highly motivated because they are promised martyrdom in death compared to, say, the secular messaging of Saddam's government. Teenagers in Iran actually volunteered to run onto minefields to clear mines by blowing them up with their bodies. Because the West hates Iran, they back Saddam in this war that he started. 1 million people die in this war for no reason, no gain whatsoever. So they sign a peace treaty with Iran and Iraq gains nothing out of this war. But despite not winning the war, Saddam builds these massive arms of victory commemorating the fact that he won the war, even though they didn't. So the arms of victory are huge. It's these two arms coming out of the ground, each holding a sword, and the swords are crossed. And at the base of the statue, on either side of the arms, are the helmets of dead Iranian soldiers. And the hands that are used in the statue, it's wrong to call it statue because it's just so big, are actually modeled on Saddam's own hands. One of the horrific things that Saddam is remembered for is what happens towards the end of the war. He begins ethnically cleansing Iraq of the ethnic Kurds in the north of Iraq. Kurds are a separate ethnic group that has their own language, and they live in northern Iraq, northern Syria, and southern Turkey. Saddam and his government, with his friend Chemical Ali, drop poison gas on Kurdish towns in northern Iraq. Half in these towns die, the other half are disabled. These chemical weapons were actually developed by the Nazis, and Hitler refused to use them. Along with the chemical weapons, the Kurds are rounded up and sent to camps to be killed, and somewhere between 50 and 100,000 Kurds are killed.
And at one stage, didn't Saddam try and blame that attack on Iran?
Yeah.
To try and deflect?
That's right.
This sounds like the sort of thing he'd do.
So along with the chemical weapons, throughout the 70s, Saddam embarks on a nuclear weapons program. They also dabble with biological weapons. And the materials are mostly bought from German companies. And in 1981, the nuclear program is up and running. They don't have any bombs yet, but they're on their way. And Israel actually bombs the reactor, which existed just outside Baghdad. He was also developing, this is what I really like. So he's also developing what's called a super gun, which was a 156-meter long gun barrel based on a space gun that was first designed to shoot projectiles into orbit. The idea of this gun was so that they could fire bombs into Israel and Iran. And in terms of the construction and the design, the way it worked, it's literally just a big gun. The materials all came from Britain, despite them having an embargo on selling weapons to Iraq at this point. And the project ended when the head engineer, Canadian named Gerald Bull, was killed while he was in Belgium. We don't know for sure, but most people believe it was done by Israeli secret police because they were quite worried that Mr. Bull was getting very close to being able to help Iraq send bombs directly into Israel. But they also think maybe it was the CIA or maybe MI6 or maybe Syria or maybe the Chileans. This is 1990 and this guy's just getting killed in his apartment in Belgium by the secret police. Like, it's very James Bond. I like it. Iraq, at the end of the war, is in terrible shape economically. Saddam maintains power with violence, fear, and near omnipresent propaganda. His face is everywhere on posters, on money. There's a pop song about Saddam, and he erects a statue on his birthday every year. And there's an Iraqi joke that I like, and it goes, there's 32 million people in Iraq, 16 million people are trying to flee, and the other 16 million are Saddam's posters. I've noticed these oppressed people under these dictators come up with the best jokes. Iraq, because of the failed invasion of Iran, owe the various Arab states $40 billion. Saddam is desperate, so he decides to invade Kuwait in 1990. And the US is not happy about this because they're friends with Kuwait. George H.W. Bush, which is the first Bush, says, "We are dealing with Hitler revisited." So the US has gone from arming and supporting Saddam to calling him Hitler in about 3 years. Uncle Ian, the Americans like backing a horse and they often back the wrong horse, but that doesn't stop them showing up to the track.
Indeed. Interestingly, Saddam tried to justify the invasion of Kuwait, not from the point of view of getting their oil or wiping away the debts, but stated that it had always been part of Iraq and it was only the British colonial system that had led to Kuwaiti independence. So he believed that he was entitled to incorporate Kuwait into Iraq.
I think that's a decision for Kuwait to make, not for Saddam to make. Okay, fair enough. Nice history lesson, but realistically, it's up to the people of Kuwait to decide whether they want to be led by a guy with his own pop song.
Yeah, I don't think Saddam was that big on plebiscites. We'll meet some other dictators who did enjoy a plebiscite, but I don't think Saddam was keen on that.
George Bush compares Saddam to Hitler. He's not too far off, but Iraq is not Germany. On January 16, 1991, the US leads a coalition in Operation Desert Storm, which defeats the Iraqi army in 100 hours. They decide to leave Saddam in power in Iraq. This is partly because the Iraqis have already begun a revolt, and the US thought it would be better if the Iraqis themselves kick out their own dictator. But Saddam brutally represses the revolt. He kills 60,000 Shia Muslims. He drains the Mesopotamian marshes, which is home to the Marsh Arabs, where the uprising was organized. This was considered one of the greatest ecological disasters of the 20th century, and it has a lot of historical and religious significance because this is the believed location of the Garden of Eden. The other horrific thing that Saddam does at this time is he has the Air Force drop loose flour on Kurdish towns that looks a lot like the gas that was dropped on the towns at the end of the 80s. It sends a message that I can get you at any time, and 2 million Kurds flee to refugee camps. We spoke last week about when we discussed Genghis Khan, we spoke about having an ongoing winner of the greatest dictatorial act. I think dropping flour on the Kurds to remind them of the poison gas attack that's already happened is probably the maddest dictatorial act I've heard so far.
Yeah, it's pretty horrid. The Kurds still seek for a homeland even today.
This has been depressing. I hate Saddam.
For good reason. I think there's a time element to that as well. I mean, a lot of this is too soon. Whereas you're right, you can talk about eunuchs, you can talk about chicken sandwiches, but the concept of being able to look at this bloke and his regime in anything other than horror, given that it's only, what, 17 years since he was toppled.
Following the revolt that followed the failed invasion of Kuwait, Saddam remains in power and boldly claims that he defeated the Americans. I don't understand how he does this, but he effectively says, oh, well, I wasn't toppled, so therefore I defeated the Americans. At this point, his messaging becomes less secular. To unite the country behind him, he starts using more Islamic language and more Islamic symbols because he's scared of losing his grip. So Saddam's looking for a shared foundation, a shared belief system that he can use to shore up his support. This is Allah. He builds a mosque to commemorate the victory, he says, over the Americans. The mosque itself is covered in anti-US writings, and the minarets are shaped like missiles. That's got to be sacrilege, surely. Surely somewhere was saying that, no, mate, you can't be doing this. He also gets a Quran made, and it's written entirely in his own blood. The Quran's not that short. It's impressive.
It certainly shows a commitment. Yeah. do we know what happened to this Quran? Was it put on display in a museum?
I believe it was put on in that mosque. Saddam, he has failed to bring glory to Iraq through economics. He has failed to bring glory to Iraq through war. So he resolves to achieve glory through sport, which I can get behind. So he appoints his first son, Uday, as head of Iraqi's Olympic Committee and soccer team. This would be a mistake. Uday has a horrific motivational style. He would murder, rape, or torture athletes that lost. So, for example, for losing a game against Jordan 2-0, the Iraqi soccer team were dragged along concrete until the skin on their backs peeled off, and then thrown in sand, and then thrown in a vat of sewage so it would become infected. When the national volleyball team lost, Uday constructed a small room with 5-foot-high ceilings, so the very tall volleyballers would be forced into this room and be held for hours, stand hunched, trying to compress themselves in this tiny room.
That's a sick mind.
How do you even come up with this? The result, of course, is that no one wanted to play sport. So by the Sydney Olympic Games, only 4 Iraqis competed because they didn't want to put up with Uday. Uday is likely more sadistic than his father. He's a famous rapist. When Uday attended university, the girls would go and hide in the bathroom so that they wouldn't be seen by him and attract his attention, because they know where that would lead. He raped the beauty queen of Baghdad. Her father complained to Saddam, and Saddam ordered to have the father killed. One final story about Uday Hassan. In 1988, Saddam takes on a mistress introduced to him by his valet and food taster. Saddam only eats lobster, which is flown in, and is inspected by nuclear scientists and tasted before he eats it. Uday believes that his father having this mistress is an insult to his mother. At a party held for the First Lady of Egypt, Uday kills the taster with a carving blade in front of all the guests. Saddam orders to have Uday killed, but the King of Jordan changes his mind. Saddam and the King of Jordan would fish together. The King of Jordan suspected Saddam had someone diving in the river attaching fish to the end of his line because Saddam was probably cheating somehow because he kept pulling up these fish that the King of Jordan never was able to do. And he was probably right. While his country descends into financial ruin, Saddam Hussein begins writing romantic fiction. He publishes his first novel, Zabada and the King, in 2000. It sold over 1 million copies in Iraq. Uncle Ian, did you know that he was a romance fiction novelist?
I was not aware of that.
I'm so excited. Oh, no. The novel is very bad. But in the novel, the King of Iraq falls in love with a peasant girl named Zababa. The King represents Saddam, and Zababa represents the people of Iraq. Zababa's husband rapes her, and he, of course, represents America. There's also a character that represents the Jews, and Saddam, as the author, often gets distracted and goes on long rants on unrelated subjects that interrupts the plot. For example, there's this. Okay, strap yourself in. Even an animal respects a man's desire if it wants to copulate with him. Doesn't a female bear try to please a herdsman when she drags him into the mountains, as it happens in the north of Iraq? She drags him into her den, so he, obeying her desire, would copulate with her. What? There's two theories. Either the bear represents Russia, but there's also a theory that he's just having a go at the Kurds. The book is full of rants against the Jews, but it also has some surprising passages on the treatment of women by powerful men and the benefits of a free democracy. It's really not completely what you'd expect. There's a lot of sensible liberal ideas in there that make you question why he acts the way he does if he's such a big believer in democracy and the will of the people. Saddam writes 3 more books, all equally bad, and the final book is sent to the publisher a day before the Americans invade Iraq in 2003. He's really lost interest in rule by this point. He just wants to sit around and write his novels. The Iraq War. We have to talk about the reasons for it, why it happened, and what happens to Saddam. So after the war with Kuwait in 1990 and 91, the UN places sanctions on Iraq, which cripples their economy. And they do this because Saddam won't let UN inspectors in to look for nuclear weapons, but Saddam won't let them into the country. In 1991, inspectors actually try to intercept a truck that they believe contains either nuclear or chemical weapons, and they are actually shot at by Iraqis. Saddam's 2 sons-in-law, who are also his cousins. Okay, so they're named Saddam and Hussein, and they're married to his daughters. So I'm a bit suspicious about that. These 2 sons-in-law, they defect to Jordan, and they tell MI6 and the CIA about Saddam's weapons programs. And a lot of what the MI6 and CIA thought they knew came from these 2 sources. These 2 sons-in-law, the Kamels, Saddam Kamel and Hussein Kamel, they return to Iraq. And Saddam wants them killed instead of just killing them the normal way. The 2 brothers are held up in their family home, and Saddam sends in a truck full of weapons and just leaves it there for the 2 brothers. Then sends in 30 armed men, and they engage in a 13-hour firefight. The house is blown up. One of the brothers dies in the explosion. The other brother stumbles out and then is shot to pieces. And that ends the life of the Kamels. So dramatic and unnecessary. Things change in 2001 when the Islamist terrorist group Al-Qaeda attacked America on September 11. George Bush starts talking about invading Iraq because of Saddam's secret support of Al-Qaeda. Bush keeps talking about invading Iraq because of their nuclear and chemical weapons program that Saddam does not have at this point. So Saddam backs down and lets weapons inspectors in. They find 1 working chemical warhead and 32 missiles, and they tell Saddam to destroy it, and then they leave. Saddam has no weapon and tells America that he was just pretending to have weapons. He was keeping up the mystery because he was scared of Iran, and so he wanted Iran to believe that he had these weapons.
But in reality, that was a bluff.
He didn't have them, but he wouldn't let inspectors in because he didn't want to be publicly demonstrated to not have the weapons. But in 2003, America and Britain claim Saddam is hiding weapons from inspectors. But the intelligence that they base that off is wrong, and America and their friends invade Iraq. The army is defeated, but not killed, and the army just melts away into the population. Saddam is captured and guarded by US soldiers, and he's actually becomes really friendly with the dozen or so soldiers that guard him. The soldiers aren't rotated, and Saddam is famously charming and manipulative. In 2006, when Saddam is hanged, the soldiers that guarded him start crying because they've developed this close relationship with Saddam. So Saddam's legacy is quite complicated by what happens next. In response to the invasion, an insurgency of terrorist groups emerged to fight the foreign armies. And then in 2011, the new American president, Barack Obama, withdraws troops from Iraq. And as a result, the terrorists take over. ISIS, which is a Al-Qaeda splinter group, take over Iraq and then move into Syria. And ISIS use Saddam's own generals. When ISIS take the city of Mosul, they do so with sleeper cells consisting of the former Iraqi government army. And when they take the city, they hang up posters of Saddam Hussein. The ISIS leadership contact them and say, you can't be doing that. We only have one symbol, and that's the ISIS flag. You cannot be putting up photos of Saddam. He's a famous secularist, and we are an Islamist group. ISIS take over most of Iraq, also parts of Syria. We've just spoke for 20 minutes about how horrific Saddam was, and yet this group comes after him, immediately after him, as soon as he's removed, that possibly even worse. There's famous footage of the Saddam Hussein statue being pulled down by the Iraqi people. And there's a interview that's been conducted with one of the people who pulled down that statue, who said, following the rise of ISIS, that he wishes that Saddam was back. He was able to keep these terrorist groups in line. The Americans did not find a weapon of mass destruction, and then later just said that the war was for the sake of regime change.
Because there's a couple of elements to it. One is looking at the last days of Saddam Hussein and the trial, and what I recall is the almost inevitable carrying out of the execution, comparing that with, as you say, the state of Iraq in subsequent years. That I think what that gentleman said with the interview was almost that Saddam was like the devil you know, whereas ISIS is a lot less predictable. Looking now as to whether the Iraqi people are any better off, it's hard to say that they would be, even despite the overthrow of Saddam and the Ba'ath Party. I personally remember thinking it was a shame that the actual execution, the filming of the execution, was what we'd now say went viral, because it was captured on a mobile phone and was on every television screen in the world. And there was almost a perception of a revenge component of that. Revenge for having had to go to war against Saddam in 1991 and again in 2003. I don't think that helped in terms of the long-term future of Western influence in Iraq.
Once they found out there was no weapons, they didn't just leave. They stayed on and presided over an attempt to reform the Iraqi government.
At the time, my recollection is that the use of weapons of mass destruction as the justification in 2003 was based on fairly flimsy evidence. The changing of horses from that reason to the reason being, oh, well, it's regime change. That in itself might be an appropriate aim, but there were a lot of other regimes in the world that were screaming out for change at the time as well. And we may well cover some of those countries in a future. In the 21st century, there's not too many invasions that have been justified by use of the term regime change. So it did appear to be a very short-term explanation when the weapons of mass destruction turned out not to be there after all. In all of this, the perception was that the invasion, apart from any revenge component against Saddam, was all about securing access to oil, to make sure that the Persian Gulf was still able to be used to move oil to the Western world.
This entire story is so sad. Poor Iraqis, poor because of a war they didn't need. They're suffering from an incredible amount of repression and violence and torture and rape and everything under the sun. And then they go through a war with the United States. And then at the end of that, they come out of it with ISIS.
Oh, they've been through a lot. The fact that there's still the Sunni-Shia divide, there's still the tensions with their neighbours, there's still the challenges faced by the Kurd to the north of Iraq, and those Kurds that have moved over into Turkey are facing their own challenges in eastern Turkey as well. We were led to believe at the time by those in power in the Coalition of the Willing, as it was called, that the US would lead the reconstruction of Iraq, much in the same way as Japan and West Germany got to be reconstructed after the Second World War. Just a couple of observations on the putting together of the alliance in 2003. The alliance that Britain and Australia joined, but to the immense disappointment of the US President George W. Bush, France did not join the coalition. And as a reaction to that, the US President stated that he believed that food shops in the United States that hitherto sold French fries should no longer call them that.
What?
They should instead be renamed Freedom Fries.
Oh my God. Is that real? There's no way that's real. Is that real?
Yeah, that's. I remember that at the time because Bush was so disappointed at the French not joining.
So now we have to compare our two dictators, Xerxes of Persia and Saddam Hussein of Iraq. We're going to look at a few things. Who is the biggest, baddest, meanest dictator? And who is the most significant? Would you agree that Xerxes is the more significant dictator? Would we have heard of Saddam Hussein? Would we remember Saddam Hussein if not for the controversial invasion of Iraq in 2003?
Will we still be talking about Saddam Hussein in 2,500 years' time? Yeah, I don't think so. Partially because by then we won't be using oil. What makes Xerxes significant is the fact that his wars and his father's wars against the Greeks were the start of recorded history in the West, thanks to Herodotus and subsequently Thucydides. That in itself makes Xerxes and the Persians significant in the same way that Western literature with the Iliad and Homer romanticising the Trojan War. That's why we remember the Trojan War and all the characters of that time. So I think it's the literary component and the written history component that makes Xerxes significant and why we remember him.
The Persian invasion of Greece is the origin story of Greece and almost the origin story of Europe. It's the famous repelling of the 5 million man army that creates a degree of unity within Greece. And ancient Greece is seen as the foundation of all that is good that has come out of Europe, the mathematics and philosophy and democracy. That story will go on forever, democracy surviving the invaders.
And in battles that happened after that, whether it was the Crusades, whether it was the end of the Eastern Roman Empire with the fall of Byzantium in the 15th century, the fact that the Greeks were able to resist the invasions by Persia, that was history that Europeans wanted to read. That's why the Persians are significant in the 5th century BC.
In terms of significance, we can't ignore that at the time it's the largest empire ever built, stretching across 3 continents.
And you're right, it was very stable.
It's a huge effort. I think it's fair to say that in the category of biggest, baddest, meanest, Saddam beats Xerxes on that account.
Oh, look, based on the sources we've got, there's no contest. There's no doubt Saddam's the biggest, baddest, meanest by quite a margin. I must admit, part of me would like to knock Saddam out of the tournament just so we don't have to talk about him anymore.
This is my argument for Saddam staying in the competition. The Persian Empire is far more significant, the modern Iraqi state. But I don't think Xerxes was significant in building or maintaining it.
Yeah, that's probably a fair component. I think you're right. I think in terms of him as an individual, it's more difficult for him to stay. It's very hard to see how you could not put Saddam forward.
Xerxes is eliminated, and Saddam Hussein, unfortunately, remains in the competition to be crowned history's biggest dictator. Congratulations to Saddam.
I think, too, if we're looking at what defines a dictator, coming to power through a coup, and in reality, they had several coups leading up to his takeover in 1979, and then being toppled from power, quite literally, if you look at the photo of the statue, and even going on trial. So some of that feeds into what we've always imagined a dictator to be.
He is a stereotypical dictator. I don't know, do we have a photo of Saddam wearing medals?
I haven't seen one.
No, he's not a medal wearer.
Which is a shame.
That's all he's missing. If we've got a bingo of dictator bingo, we've got moustache.
Thanks for that.
We've got moustache. We've got coup. We've got the purging of his own party members. Ethnic cleansing.
Multiple marriages.
Eating lobster while his countrymen are starving.
Strange children.
Very strange children. Smoking cigars. Drinking alcohol despite apparently being a devout Muslim.
Early worthwhile achievements that were internationally recognised.
That's it. That's another one. Oh, and the award from UNESCO. Someone's got to get fired for that. Oh, what'd you do today, darling? Oh, today the UN department, we awarded a Medal of Honor to Saddam Hussein. Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah, wonder how he'll get on.
But no medals, unfortunately, so we can't get Dictator Bingo in this episode.
He does tick a lot of the boxes. So, Scott, who are we going to cover next time?
Next week, we are heading to the Caribbean. We have communist dictator Fidel Castro up against the Haitian dictator Duvalier. Very keen for this one. Uncle Ian, speak to you then.
Look forward to it.